This is Audible.
Tantor Audio presents Hill 488 by Ray Hildreth and Charles W. Sasser, narrated by Jonathan Yen. Introduction. In the East Room of the White House on 21 August 1967, Gunnery Sergeant Jimmy Earl Howard stood proudly at attention while President Lyndon B. Johnson placed the blue-starred Congressional Medal of Honor around his neck. He was the sixth U.S. Marine to win the nation's highest award for valor during the Vietnam War. President Johnson praised Howard as a professional Marine who was typical of the men who endure the savage heat of battle abroad so that their countrymen may walk in peace here at home. With tears in his eyes, the grizzled Marine with short-cropped, prematurely graying hair stepped to the microphone to accept the honor and to give credit to the 15 Marines and two Navy corpsmen who, with him, defended Hill 488 against an estimated 400 to 450 well-disciplined North Vietnamese Army regulars and Viet Cong Main Force guerrillas throughout a terror-filled night in June 1966. He began to speak in a hesitant voice. "I don't know how to speak, gentlemen," he said, "but I want to say in all sincerity..." His voice wavered and broke. He finally waved a hand at the survivors of that unbelievable night of horror and courage who were all present for the ceremony. "That's the guys who did it right there." The medal belonged as much to them, he said, as to himself. He took the president by the hand and personally introduced him to each man who lived through that most improbable battle of modern warfare. The defense of Hill 488, also called Nuivu Hill, was certainly about individual courage. Men like Howard endured the bitter winter at Valley Forge, stormed the Normandy beaches, fought alongside John F. Kennedy in the Pacific. They faced aggression on the frozen hills of Korea and manned lonely fire bases in Vietnam. But Hill 488 was also something more than individual courage. If the action had centered around only the one man, it might have been considered a unique incident of exceptional bravery by an exceptional man. As it turned out, however, uncommon valor was a common virtue that surmounted the courage of any single individual. That phrase is inscribed on the U.S. Marine Corps War Memorial in Arlington, Virginia, spoken by Admiral Chester Nimitz to describe the heroism of those who fought on Iwo Jima during World War II. It is a maxim that certainly applies to the members of Howard's platoon. 1st Platoon of Charlie Company, 1st Reconnaissance Battalion, 1st Marine Division, became the most highly decorated unit of its size in the entire history of the United States military. Decorations included the Medal of Honor, 4 Navy Crosses, the nation's second highest award for valor, 13 Silver Stars, the third highest valor awards, and 18 Purple Hearts. Every man on the hill was either killed or wounded. Few would have noticed anything unique or particularly special about 1st Platoon before the night of 15-16 June 1966. The men of the platoon were a sampling from places all over the nation: New York, California, Tennessee, New Mexico, Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma. Even though they had been selected and trained for reconnaissance, and 4 were trained snipers, they were in most respects typical American young men, most of whom were recently still in high school. They were an average lot, country and city boys, who underwent the seemingly magical training process by which green recruits become United States Marines. Perhaps this training was their great strength. It allowed them to rise above normal expectations to fight one of the truly great stands in all of history. As one Marine officer stated after studying the after-action reports, "This was an Alamo with survivors." Those who survived, those few, those brave, those Marines, owe it to both individual and group courage. Those who lived and those who died were true American heroes. This is the story of the exceptional men who made their valiant stand on the hill, recorded so history may never forget that such Americans exist. Charles W. Sasser. Foreword. When many Americans think about Vietnam, visions of negative headlines such as My Lai Massacre, Pot-Smoking Marines, Baby Killers, War Protests, AWOL Soldier Seeks Sanctuary, and Draft Dodgers come to their minds. I would like for these people to realize that many Vietnam veterans never used illegal drugs and did not intentionally kill innocent civilians. Most of us who served in Vietnam prior to 1968, in my opinion, went there with a different attitude. We never questioned whether, morally or politically, we should have been in Vietnam. We never talked about it. We were told and believed that we were helping a country to stave off communism and upholding the ideals of our way of life and government. What we wondered about most was why we, the American fighting men, were not allowed to conduct the type of campaigns that would ultimately win the war. Maybe, in retrospect, we should not have been involved in the Vietnam conflict, but those of us who served there did not have the luxury of that choice. We were there as representatives of the people of the United States of America, sent by our elected officials of the United States government to uphold American ideology, and we certainly did not deserve the type of treatment and negligence that we received upon our return. I think that many Americans now recognize that the Vietnam veteran made sacrifices on their behalf, and more often I hear sincere words of thank you. Others, it seems, do not know how to express themselves or do not want to admit their part in this tragedy, so they just sweep it under the carpet. In the Marine Corps, we have a saying, Semper Fi, from the Latin words Semper Fidelis, which means always faithful. I would liken this saying to most Vietnam veterans who were honoring their oath of allegiance to be faithful to the United States of America. Ray Hildreth. Preface. If you were in the common crotch, a grunt U.S. Marine, you went where you were told, did what you were told, and tried in the process to keep your butt from getting shot off. The brass back at division or somewhere higher up moved your colored pin from place to place on the map, and you simply followed it. You rarely saw the big picture. What you saw of the war was what there was of it in your immediate vicinity. Right now, what we saw of it, PFC James McKinney and I, Lance Corporal Raymond Hildreth, wasn't much. What we saw of anything wasn't much. McKinney and I hunkered shoulder to shoulder on the eastern slope of Hill 488. It was so dark that if I scratched my nuts, I had to ask James if they were mine or his I was scratching. Vietnam defined the word dark. Breezes rustled surreptitiously through the wheat-like grass fields that covered the hill, making little whispering sighs like predators passing in the night. "Daylight belongs to us," Lance Corporal Osorio explained when I first arrived in country. "The dark belongs to them." As far as McKinney and I were concerned, we could have been on another planet 25 million miles away from Chulai, instead of a mere 25. Darkness hid danger, while at the same time providing a false security that it also hid you from danger. "Ray?" McKinney whispered, nudging me. "Yeah, I'm awake." Sergeant Howard had placed the platoon on 50% alert at dusk, which meant one of us could sleep. "Reckon there's still a world out there?" McKinney was a bit of a pessimist. "The world is what you can see, James." "It's a small world, Ray. I can't even see my feet." He edged closer. Our knees touched. Touching another human being provided a great deal of comfort when you were 2 19-year-olds in the dark, a long way from home and surrounded by people who wanted to kill you. We talked for a while, whispering about home and family and girls and cars. After a while, McKinney pulled a poncho over his head so the glow wouldn't be seen while he smoked a cigarette. He yawned and nestled down under his poncho, saying he was going to catch a few Z's. "Wake me in a couple of hours and I'll let you grab some ragtime," he said. He was soon breathing deep and regular. I repositioned my M14 across my legs. Corporal Gerald Thompson, squad leader, slipped down the hillside and dropped on one knee next to us. We were about 20 meters off the crest of the hill where Sergeant Howard had established his command post, behind a boulder about the size of a VW with the top chopped off. The rest of the platoon, also in pairs, formed a 360-degree perimeter around the top of the hill. Thompson hissed, "You guys awake?" "Yeah," I said. McKinney stirred and leaned against me in his sleep like a little brother. It had been a long day. "Sergeant Howard has put us on 100% alert. Hildreth, move over to your right about 20 meters. "What's up?" Something cold and slimy stirred inside my guts. "There's been lots of movement," Thompson whispered. "One of the other recons had to be pulled out. If we have to bug out, Hildreth, you're point man. Lead us down that draw in front and then around to the right. Got it?"
"Yeah."
He followed to check my new position. I settled down in the tall grass with my rifle, pack, and ammo belt.
"Remember to fire underneath the muzzle flashes," he said, before he moved on to pass the word.
A shiver skittered up my spine and prickled the short hairs on my neck. Folks back in Oklahoma said you got a shiver like that whenever someone walked over your future grave. Part 1. "Accursed be he that first invented war." Marlowe. 36. 23:15 hours, Wednesday, 15 June, 1966. The Special Forces soldiers were obviously correct in assuming the main force VC and NVA they spotted earlier in the evening, hundreds of soldiers, were heading somewhere on purpose and meant business. Thanks to them, Vietnamese Reds climbing the hill under cover of darkness, swiftly and silently, weren't going to massacre us in one surprise attack. Still, we were outnumbered, surrounded, unable to use our bug-out plan, and the enemy was getting set up and preparing to attack at any moment. Ominous sounds of movement, rustling, slithering, clanking of weapons, voices reached our ears. Nerves were on raw edge. The monsters of our imaginations had become real, and they were coming for us. I had never been so scared in my entire life, not even when the gooks passed by on the trail and I left my rifle with the radio. My tongue felt like a cactus in my mouth. My position had had it. There was no cover here. I had a standing order to pull back into a tight defensive perimeter if anything happened. Still, I felt reluctant to leave McKinney without checking on him. He had failed to respond when I called out to him. Any further communication would only serve to attract the enemy, and perhaps a grenade down on me. I lay there longer than I should have, listening for McKinney, hearing nothing else from him. My mind refused to acknowledge that he was probably dead, his body splintered and broken at the same time his poncho took flight. Only a few minutes ago, he had been sleeping right next to me, and now it left a hollow feeling inside. Further delay would only serve to expose me to the same fate he had already suffered. My guts wrenched, but I knew my duty. Twisting in the grass, dragging my rifle, bandolier, and pack with me, I slithered as swiftly as a lizard toward the top of the hill.
"Who's there?" someone challenged. Me?
I kept going. Thompson lay flat in the grass, and I couldn't see him, even when I was almost on top of him.
Me, who? Me, Hildreth. Damn, you almost got shot. Where's McKinney?
I told him.
Sweet Jesus.
He exhaled and crawled away to report to Sergeant Howard. Sergeant Howard was busy making the perimeter tighter, assigning firing positions through his squad and team leaders, and checking on casualties. Two of them already, one seriously wounded and one likely dead, and those in just the first brief exchange. Thompson came back and positioned me between Mascarenhas on my left and Adams on my right. Our area of responsibility lay toward the east and the saddle in the ridgeline below. At the same time, the rest of the platoon also realigned itself in the smaller perimeter, everyone prone and hugging the ground. The defensive 360 was no more than 20 paces across, with the big rock at its apex. The crown of the hill offered almost no cover, the old VC fighting holes being further down on the slopes. In my mind's eye, I saw VC already wriggling into the hole I shared with Mascarenhas the 2 days we were on the hill. Nothing loud was going on at the moment, which seemed to emphasize the hard urgency in Sergeant Howard's voice as he got on the radio and described the situation to the battalion CP.
"We're under fire. Enemy close," he said in a voice remarkably calm and focused. "We need flares. We need the box fired, and we need it now."
Artillery batteries commonly preset potential targets on their maps and plotting boards in order to be able to fire the box during hours of darkness. A box was usually included as part of a unit's defensive measures when it went to the field.
"Hit all around the perimeter to keep them off us,"
the sergeant continued, his voice disembodied in the night, alerting the world outside this tiny hilltop that Marines were in trouble.
"I've got one serious wounded and one missing. Start a medevac."
It was so quiet it was almost like nothing had ever happened. Another still night on a hilltop in Vietnam. I peered down the slope into the darkness, thinking of advice my half-brother Homer gave me before I left for Vietnam. "Whenever you have the enemy in your sights," he said, "don't hesitate by trying to rationalize right from wrong. Just squeeze the trigger. You'll have time to think about it later." Knowing that some of your own people were hurt exerted a strong psychological effect on those of us who were not. We were all mature young men who had worked, trained, and striven to reach self-confidence and self-sufficiency, just now beginning to appreciate what we could do and enjoy, and suddenly we were threatened with the possibility that it could all end. Death, for men so young and ready to live, was a brutal personal affront, an unforgivable insult. Along with our fear came a natural, understandable intensity of rage at those who might take everything away from us. Not a Marine on Nui Vu that night's beginning held a single qualm against killing. When it came down to them or us, it was going to be them. 23:18 hours. We defenders had the advantage of high ground and looking down the enemy's throat when he started up. The enemy had the advantage of the cover of darkness, firepower, and superior numbers. Just how superior in numbers we had yet to realize. It hardly seemed fair to Lance Corporal Bob Martinez as he inched to the end of the big rock next to the shallow sump hole and squinted into the night. Sergeant Howard was on the radio. Mulvihill's radio had been turned off to save as a spare and for emergencies. Martinez saw nothing, but he kept looking anyhow. He heard movement all around the hill. Tension clamped his jaws so tight he wasn't sure if he'd ever be able to open his mouth again. Powell's, lying in the safety of the big rock, was in bad shape. Morphine hushed his screaming, but instead of euphoria, the drug had produced a type of paranoid schizophrenia that caused the wounded Marine to moan and whimper in fear. While Billy Dee and Doc Fitz worked on his wound, getting in a spike and administering IV fluids, Binns kept talking to him in a soothing whisper, lying to him, telling him he was going to be all right, that he'd be going home now with a $1 million wound. Powell's had always looked up to Binns. 23:20 hours. Sergeant Howard crawled around the tiny perimeter on his belly, touching each one of us, encouraging us, bolstering our spirit. He assured us we'd be backed up by artillery and air support. Assets should be on station and prepared to cover us within the next few minutes. It occurred to me that providing fire cover might be difficult under the circumstances, in the dark, with the enemy literally breathing in our faces. I refrained from asking questions, however, because I wanted to believe it could be done. Sometimes reality came in doses too large to take all at once.
"Hold your fire until you can see them," Sergeant Howard said. "Pick your targets, and don't shoot at shadows. Don't waste ammo. Remember, we don't have an unlimited supply."
It seemed on face value that we had sufficient, but before the night ended, even 5,000 rounds a man would not seem like enough.
"We need the machine gun," Carlisi murmured. "If Benson hadn't gotten hurt..."
"A machine gun would do us little good," Sergeant Howard replied. "It's a prime target at close range. So is an automatic weapon. Fire only on semi-automatic, unless you want to be singled out by every gook on the hill. Good luck, men."
23:22 hours. Earlier that evening of the 15th at Chulai, Battalion Command Sergeant Major Turner, a wiry career Marine in his 40s, attended a briefing with Colonel Arthur Sullivan and other battalion officers and ranking non-coms. Subject matter concerned the 7 recon teams still ensconced around the rim of the Hyeopdok Valley, gathering intelligence and providing sightings to the pending second phase of Operation Kansas. The colonel was especially concerned with the status of 1st Platoon Charlie Company. Howard's platoon had been inserted the deepest and had reported the most enemy activity. A Special Forces CIDG unit spotted large enemy concentrations moving toward Hill 488 shortly after nightfall. Artillery barrages failed to disperse them. Colonel Sullivan and his operations officer, Major Jack Cooper, expressed fear that the enemy movement came in response to fire missions Howard had been directing into the valley since the evening of the 13th.
"The VC aren't stupid," the colonel said. "They're going to figure it out. Howard wanted to stay another night. I let him. I want Howard out of there. Jack, you and the sergeant major work up an extraction plan."
Turner and Major Cooper took on the task, and soon had everything lined up for a pickup of the platoon at first light. It was too late tonight, too dark, and the terrain too imposing. The sergeant major had had almost no sleep since Monday when the operation began. He made his way to his cot at about 2200 hours. At that time, Carnival Times still reported everything quiet on its quarter-hourly sit-reps. He had barely fallen asleep when a commotion in the communications tent next door pulled him into awareness. Somebody rapped on his tent.
"I'm awake," he rasped. "This had better be good. What is it?"
It was a corporal from S2.
"Sergeant Major, we got a team in trouble."
Turner immediately launched to his feet and out into the night. All he had to do was slip on his boots. He had been sleeping in his utility since Kansas began. A cool breeze blew in off the South China Sea.
"Which team?" he asked, although he already suspected. "Sergeant Howard's. You want me to wake the colonel?" "I'll get him."
The Camo ops tent became crowded within minutes as the bad news spread. Colonel Sullivan and his executive officer, Major Scotty Harris, operations officer, Major Jack Cooper, Charlie Company's commander, Captain Tim Garrity, Staff Sergeant Williams, S2 NCOIC radio operators, intel personnel, logistics people. Banks of radios against the tent walls chattered and crackled unrelentingly as the various support elements of the marine green machine cranked into action. Aircraft, artillery, ready reaction forces. It seemed everybody jumped on the duty frequency, trying to get a part of the action, volunteering to do whatever they could or was required. Marines were in trouble. It got so crowded on both the working channels and in the tent that Colonel Sullivan had to start kicking non-essential hangers-on off the radio and out of the tent. 23:23 hours. Nothing, I thought, could be as bad as the waiting and the silence. I was wrong. I almost jumped out of my skin when the first bamboo sticks began clacking. From somewhere down below came a single clickety-clack rhythm echoing eerily out of the darkness. It was like the hill, haunted, stretched and rattled its teeth. Almost before I caught my breath, others took up the signaling until a wave of clicking flowed like a tidal wave around the hilltop, and we were completely encircled by the unearthly sounds. It felt almost supernatural. I shivered. My hands trembled with the full realization of our predicament. It was little consolation to know that my comrades were likewise frozen with fear. I was raised on Saturday afternoon matinees at the old Circle Theater in Tulsa's Brookside area. I knew what happened when the Apache drums stopped beating, or natives in the Congo pounded frantically on their hollow logs, then abruptly ceased. The next thing you knew, Randolph Scott was fighting off all the Indians in the world, or Van Heflin was preparing for a final stand against painted African savages, masked to rid the world of our hero. I almost jumped out of my skin a second time when the bamboo sticks stopped as suddenly as they began. Something just as terrible and unreal took their place. Whistles blew, shrieking of tormented souls buried inside the hill. There was also a bugle further down. Either that or my electrified imagination was running amok and driving me mad. I felt like I was living in a nightmare from hell. Suddenly, even the whistles stopped. Black objects filled the air against the backdrop of stars. Hailstones the size of fists pelted down on top of the hill out of a stormless sky. I heard them hitting the ground, like rocks. The crazy bastards were throwing rocks at us. One of the rocks exploded. "Jesus God! Grenades!" Somebody yelled, "The motherfuckers are coming!" 37. 23:25 hours, Wednesday, 15 June, 1966. Nuivu had stirred, clacked its terrible bamboo teeth, shrieked through the whistles, and now it seemed to go apeshit. From a distance, from down in the valley, it must have resembled the site of an amazing 4th of July celebration, or a volcano erupting. Balls of searing lights from grenades popped in random firecracker strings, dusting the black sky with flickering reflection. Strategically placed heavy machine guns lacerated the hill, their streams of bright bluish-green tracers weaving back and forth. AK-47s and M-14s traded savage fire. Men screamed and yelled on both sides, at each other, at themselves, at God. The din of the breaking battle rumbled across the valley, echoing and clapping and reverberating. The ground trembled. Chaos, noise, and confusion reigned. The attack continued for the next quarter hour, but it seemed to last forever. Waves of VC charged first one sector, then another, under cover of their grenades, machine guns, and small mortars. Not a mass assault such as the Japanese and Koreans made notorious. These guys fought smart, popping up and down in the grass, probing to find a weak spot to exploit. Firing and maneuvering, cover and assault elements. Crawling right up to our lines and throwing grenades
before being hurled back or retreating with their asses blistered, only to attack again somewhere else.
"Holy shit!" Binns yelled. "This is a big one!"
Pulled back into our tight circle, the platoon fought literally back to back, defending our tiny perimeter of Earth, counting on each other to work as a team, to become instant combat vets, and do the seemingly impossible by throwing back the assault. Sergeant Howard must have had doubts about how his cherry troops would react. I would have, had I been in his place. It was the platoon's first time in major combat. Most of us were young and untried, the first time out for several of us. Outnumbered by more than 20 to 1, shocked and confused by the ferocity of the attack and the screams of the wounded. The situation looked hopeless. We hugged the ground amid the crash of grenades and mortars, below a dark sky spiderwebbed with tracer rounds. Giant flashbulbs from grenade explosions winked us in and out of sight of each other, bringing into momentary relief pale, stricken faces. Yet we fought back out of sheer guts and desperation, this greenhorn recon platoon. No seasoned outfit could have done better. A man fighting for his life and for the life of the buddy next to him always failed to see the big picture of a battle. For him, everything became fragmented with distinct events compressed into comprehensible bites. The whole of his life, from now into forever, focused on that precise moment and what was happening within the boundary of his own senses, gone acute from danger and fear. A battle was like the parts of a puzzle in which each man possessed a single piece. He saw his own piece, and that piece differed from how the man next to him saw his. It was said that each warrior fought his own battle within the larger battle, sort of like life. Sergeant Howard feared it was Katie bar the door. Without illumination, he found it difficult to calculate precisely the size of the opposing force. He knew by the volume of fire, however, that it was a large element. He estimated a battalion because of the number and variety of weapons. At least 4 50-caliber heavy machine guns chunking away from cross-firing angles. Maybe a 51 with its slow, cyclic rate of fire that sounded like someone was cranking out rounds with a handle. At least 2 30-cal light machine guns, RPD automatic assault rifles, 60-millimeter mortars, Chinese-made potato masher grenades with the throwing handles, and a variety of different-sounding small arms. He spotted no webbing fire trails from the use of RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, as of yet, and probably wouldn't. The RPG was an area-point weapon, difficult to place on a small target like the top of the hill without endangering your own troops. The attack seemed to be concentrating on 2 sides of the hill, on the north, where Binns dinged the first soldier, and on the more gentle western slope, where the climbing was faster and easier. Some grenades bounced off the big rock, rolled back down the slope, and blew up among the attackers. A number were duds. Many landed inside the perimeter and winged shrapnel through the air. Men cried out in surprise and pain. The sergeant crawled among his men, a reassuring presence as he directed fire or shored up weaknesses in the perimeter. He triggered off rounds at flitting shadows, but he always returned to the radio. The platoon was lost without its lifeline.
"We need flares," he pleaded. "Iron Hand, we need that box bad."
From the Vietnamese point of view, the start of the fight must have seemed to be going well. Green tracers from machine guns streaked toward the Marine positions, pointing the direction for reinforcements assembling in the lower draws. Heavy explosive mortar projectiles arced in from 4 points of the compass, smashing down and contributing rock splinters to the buzz of metal shrapnel while forcing the defenders to hug the ground. Screaming and shouting, dark figures scrambled up the steep slopes like demons out of hell, firing their weapons as they came, intent on victory at any cost. It would all be over in short order, from the Vietnamese point of view. 23:28 hours. At Chulai, Executive Officer Scotty Harris in the battalion CP didn't realize how bad things were on Hill 488 until Howard came up on the push requesting, demanding, pleading for assistance.
"Two casualties," Sergeant Howard reported. "One critical, one missing. We need medevac if he's going to make it."
"Medevac is in the air, carnival time," Colonel Sullivan said. "He should be arriving over you now."
It was a decided boost to morale for troops to know they could be evacuated from a firefight and reach a hospital quicker than someone involved in an automobile accident on a highway back in the United States. The average elapsed time between a field injury and surgery was little more than 100 minutes. Nearly 98% of the wounded who reached medical facilities alive managed to survive. Much of the credit belonged to the rapid response and the daring of the dust-off pilots and crews. The first five medevac UH-1A Huey helicopters arrived in Vietnam in April 1962 with the Army's 57th Medical Detachment, helicopter ambulance. They were soon given the generic name Dust-Off after the call sign of Major Charles Kelly, a famous pilot killed in action in 1964. In 1966, Marines were still using H-34s for medical evacuations, but would soon switch to Hueys. Air ambulance work was a good way to get killed. Statistics showed that medevac helicopters suffered three times the losses to hostile fire than all other types of helicopter missions. Medevacs made ideal prey for the VC, who knew for sure the unarmed medevacs would come in after or even during a firefight. When the medevac from Chulai reached Hill 488, flying high above it out of range, the crew was astonished at the sound and light show going on below. Nonetheless, the pilot raised carnival time on the tactical channel and expressed willingness to attempt the pickup.
"It's suicide," Sergeant Howard reluctantly responded. There was no way the chopper could get in and out again under the present conditions. VC gunners would be shooting it at point-blank range.
"Abort the mission," Howard said.
The medevac returned to Chulai. 23:30 hours. Richard Fitzpatrick, the corpsman on his first combat mission, got hit right away. It seemed to Billy D that everybody got hit at once during the grenade hailstorm and started hollering. A grenade struck Fitz in the face and bounced off before it exploded. Billy D wormed over to him. He lay without moving. The flashing light from a mortar round illuminated his face momentarily. Billy D recoiled. He hardly recognized Fitz. The corpsman's face resembled raw hamburger, a Halloween horror mask with teeth glinting through the sides of his cheeks. He appeared dead. Billy D dragged him across the ground to the protection of the big rock, where he was establishing a collection point for casualties. He left the big man lying next to the comatose Powells. 23:32 hours. Corporal Bob Martinez sprawled at the end of the big rock and didn't know what was happening on the other three sides of the hill. He was scared half to death, like everyone else. But also, like everyone else, he had trained to react with his natural instincts. React, don't think. That was what it was all about. Don't think of anything. Just go along with events. He couldn't see shit. He stayed by the rock and the sump hole and kept his head low. Powells moaned in a drug-induced delirium. Binns and Mulvihill lay on their bellies a few feet to his right, shooting down the hill. In the dark, the enemy squatting down or crawling in the tall grass became nearly invisible. Martinez commanded a certain limited range of vision, perhaps 10 or 15 feet in front, and he pinged away every time a little piece of the night shifted. Those VC who got in that close got dinged. He knew they were coming for him. Even when he couldn't see anything, he kept shooting down into his area of responsibility, one or two rounds at a time, to let them know he was still here. They were going to have to come through steel and lead to get him. A grenade landed an arm's length away between him and Binns. Instinct made him roll away from danger. He wrapped his head inside his arms just as it exploded. Whang! The blast ruptured his eardrums. His ears rang. Sound, loud as it was, seemed to come from out of a tunnel. Was he still all in one piece? He felt himself all over for holes or blood. Finding none, he scrambled back into position in time to clobber one of the little attackers, who jumped up out of the grass almost on top of him. The guy screamed when the bullet thudded him. He tumbled backward. Martinez heard him whimpering like an injured dog as he tried to get to his feet. He squeezed the trigger twice more at the sound, and then he heard nothing else from that patch of grass.
"Binns," he whispered. "Binns, are you all right? I got a couple of pieces in my leg. How about you?" "What? What? Talk louder. I can't hear." "I said, how about you?" "I'm okay. How about you, Mulvihill?"
"Jesus God, Jesus God, Jesus God," the other radio man chanted.
Martinez was trembling all over. 23:33 hours. Bill Norman, the Arizona cowboy, worked near the northern front of the hill against the main assault. To him, an inveterate chess player and self-taught strategist, it seemed the knights and rooks and pawns suddenly came alive on the chessboard and were locked in a throat-to-throat struggle. Bullets ricocheted around him. Shrapnel whizzed. Tracers grazed overhead. There was lots of close shooting. Lots of everything. It was overwhelming. Somebody hollered that he'd been shot.
"A fucking ricochet!"
Norman kept shooting into the night. If it moved, if he thought it moved, he opened up. 23:34 hours. Private First Class Ignatius Carlisi, maybe the only guy in the world drafted into the Marines, got a finger blown off. He started hollering and screaming.
"Corman! Corman!"
Billy D crawled to him, dragging his aid bag. The little Italian settled down.
"It's not my trigger finger," Carlisi declared. "I can still shoot."
Only a ragged strip of flesh remained where Carlisi's finger had been. Billy D elbowed up on one arm to give himself room to work. Feeling for things, unable to see, he patted the wound and wrapped the hand in a battle dressing. Shit was still hitting the fan big time. Something struck the corpsman in the chest. He freaked out and started slapping at the grenade like it was a scorpion or spider dropped down the front of his shirt. The potato masher ended up hissing like a snake between his legs. Both Carlisi and he kicked at it, yelling at each other and at it. It went off, peppering both men with shrapnel and momentarily blinding them with its flash. By some miracle, both survived. The blast cone of a grenade on the ground was primarily up and out. While anyone standing or kneeling within its radius was dead meat, a prone man lying even a foot away commonly survived, even though stunned and shocked by the explosion. Billy D's face and upper chest stung from multiple tiny lacerations. He felt blood on his forehead. Carlisi now had both legs seriously mangled to go along with his lost finger. Ignoring his own wounds, wiping blood from his eyes, the corpsman patched Carlisi's legs. Both men returned to the fray. In this fight, the wounded hadn't the luxury of indulging themselves. Corpsmen carried M14 rifles in addition to their standard-issue 45 pistols. Billy D crawled over to the edge of the hill and shot a couple of 20-round rifle magazines at muzzle flashes. They winked and blinked from everywhere, like manic fireflies in swarms. Someone yelled out that he was hit. The corpsman squirmed on his belly back to the big rock to see who it was. 23:35 hours. The battle went on for what seemed a long time, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and I still hadn't fired a round. While the entire hill seemed to be erupting all around me, there I lay, hugging the earth, trying to pull the mountain around me, eyeballing my sector for movement. My side of the hill was the steeper aspect, down into the saddle, and harder for the enemy to climb. There was lots of firing on the north and west, but still none where I was. Grenades exploded near the big rock, only 15 or 20 steps away, with hard, ringing concussions. I dared not raise my head. If shrapnel didn't blast it off, machine guns would. Tracers wove delicate patterns in the black sky above my head. I heard people getting hit, crying out, "Corman!" Bins came around, sliding rapidly from man to man. Gutsy Jamaican, not a trace of fear or strain in his voice. Like it was only a training exercise. Checking the perimeter, checking on people, working as platoon sergeant to Howard's platoon leader.
"How are you doing, Hildreth?"
"So far, so good." But McKinney, I thought, McKinney wasn't doing so good. He was still down there on the side of the hill. Bins moved on. I heard a thud 5 feet away. Adam shouted, "Grenade!" Simultaneously, we rolled over the crest of the hill to get out of the blast radius. I thought the bang was going to shake me off the ground and into the hands of the enemy. Another second or two passed before I convinced myself I remained unscathed. I scrambled back up the hill. I found a shallow depression that offered some minimal cover. I rolled into it. As I lay there, panting, my heart pounding, a piece of the night right in front of my eyes shifted places. I was surprised to actually see him. Probably the same son of a bitch who tossed the grenade. Fury welled up in my throat at finally having one of the little gook bastards within my grasp. Reflexively, I fired 3 quick rounds. Then, angry or not, I paused to calculate effect, just like I'd been trained. No more movement. I got the son of a bitch. 23:37 hours. 18-year-old Thomas Glaw, the Chicago kid with attitude, turned out to be a fighting fool. Leaning across the top of the big rock with Powell's M79 grenade launcher, he took a bunch of muzzle flashes under fire. Blooping grenades as fast as he could fire, reload, and fire again, he lay down a belt of flame and exploding steel. The M79 was a breech-loading, single-shot area weapon like a big sawed-off shotgun. It fired a variety of 40-millimeter grenade rounds, including H.E. and Willie Pete. He looked back toward the center and bellowed to no one in particular.
"This is bullshit, man! We got to get the hell out of here!"
"I'm with you," Corporal Thompson agreed.
"But there's nowhere to go."
Glaw hunched down behind the rock.
"Sarge, I'm out of M79 ammo."
Sergeant Howard crawled over a couple of feet to Powell's and stripped a bandolier off his body. He tossed the heavy belt to Glaw.
"Here, catch."
"Thanks."
His armory replenished, Glaw returned to the fight, fighting like he really intended to keep his vow to wipe VC off the face of the globe. Get those medals.
"Fuck you, motherfucker! Come and get it!"
A string of bullets raked over the big rock, making slapping sounds and whining off as ricochets. A round drilled Glaw through the head, with the impact of a pickaxe smashing into a pumpkin. It spun him around on his feet and slammed him to the ground. He was dead when Billy D reached him. Blood poured from the wound in his face and head, spreading out like congealing jelly around his body. It smelled raw and nauseating. Sergeant Howard scooted over and took the M79 and the remaining grenades. 38. 23:40 hours, Wednesday, 15 June 1966. Time, under such circumstances, was hard to determine. We might have been fighting for 5 minutes, 5 hours, or anything in between. The VC threw everything they had at us, a crescendo as if they opened up with every weapon they owned, laying down a sheet of iron over our heads. Slugs zipped around like lightning strikes. Skirmishers rushed us, but Marines reacted just as savagely. Deadly accurate Marine fire cut through their ranks.
"Heads up and stand fast!" Sergeant Howard yelled. "Use grenades!"
American fragmentation grenades contained twice the blast of Chi-Com grenades, with more shrapnel effect. We also had the advantage in that the average Marine could throw further and more accurately than the average 110-pound Vietnamese. Men grunted and yelled as they hurled frags that exploded among the advancing enemy, tearing into flesh and bone. The hill shook as if it were an annoyed dog attempting to get rid of fleas. High-pitched howls and excited jabberings mingled with the explosions. Give the motherfuckers some of their own medicine. The east side of the hill, my sector, remained relatively untouched. Binns crawled over.
"Hildreth, do you have any more grenades?"
I gave him two of my four. They needed them worse over there than we did over here. We needed help. We needed it fast. Always before, help had been only a radio call away. This time it was different. Sergeant Howard, I thought, should have taken the colonel's suggestion that we be extracted. It seemed to take forever to get artillery. I almost cheered when I heard the first low whistling of arriving 105-millimeter howitzer shells. The whistling got louder and louder until they came screaming like jets going over, like compact cars being hurtled through the air at above Mach 1. You got to anticipating where they would land, and you hoped they wouldn't land on you. The first cluster of three splashed down low on the northwestern slope, about 500 meters away. Someone issued a stream of disappointed profanity, starting with, "Fuck a duck!" The shells landed where the enemy wasn't, killing dirt and rocks and grass. Sergeant Howard jumped on the radio, working the horn, calling in adjustment.
"The box is no good," he yelled. "It's 500 meters to our northwest. Adjust! Adjust!"
Three more rounds landed as he was talking, in the same area.
"No, no! Drop 400! Put that box around us! I want everything possible around the hill! Need illumination first, and fast!"
Flares arrived right over target, popping. Suddenly, three tiny bright suns appeared, swaying and undulating beneath their parachutes as they slowly drifted down, bathing the hill and surrounding draws and saddles in a weird yellowish light, like the sodium lights on parking lots, only not quite as bright. The sway of the parachutes and the flickering of the burning flares created eerie shadows fluttering and leaping about among the hordes of enemy soldiers surrounding us. In the preceding darkness, we had no true picture of what we were up against. As light cast back the darkness, however, it revealed a terrifying scene from an old horror movie in which the living dead were coming to get you. Little evil monsters crawled everywhere, popping up and down in the grass, shooting in volleys. Squads and teams firing and maneuvering, screaming hellishly. Platoons gathered in reserve on the outskirts of the battle, double-timing in the draws or maneuvering on the ridge opposite the saddle, exposed by the light like cockroaches caught in a filthy kitchen. It resembled an anthill suddenly ripped open.
"Oh, my God!"
someone squawked in disbelief. It sounded like Norman. The enemy appeared to be massing to charge in a human wave. The flares arriving in the nick of time betrayed their plan. Rifle fire increased to a spiteful level as Marines on the north and west poured lead down the hill into newly revealed targets. Norman busily shot at men on the ridgeline on the other side of the saddle. VC over there looked as small as bugs from this distance, but they were the only bad guys he could see without sitting up to look over the edge of the hill, thus exposing himself. His sniper training marksmanship allowed him to pick off one or two. In addition to the flares disclosing what confronted us, unnerving in itself, even more disturbing was what the flares revealed about ourselves. Darkness at least hid the carnage. Now the horror came into full light. There was blood everywhere. Pools and globlets on the ground, smeared on the inside of the big rock, on men's faces and uniforms. Many already wore bloody, filthy bandages on various parts of their anatomy. Arms, legs, head, hands. Billy D. had been busy. The haze of rifle smoke and explosions swirled in this living graveyard and drifted over the mangled forms of Powells, Fitzpatrick, and Glaw, all lying in a row where the corpsman had dragged them. They appeared dead. Men looked around with unbelievable shock and fear in their eyes. They looked the way I felt. Victor leaned over the top of the big rock next to Bosley, both of them capping rounds downhill. He dropped his rifle and staggered back as a grenade exploded nearby.
"I'm hit!" he screamed.
The sight of his bloodied and dead or dying comrades proved even more of a blow to his system than the shrapnel wounds. He executed a small, wobbling pirouette, swinging his arms wide. Automatic fire cracked and snapped around his head. Always the pessimist, he shrieked,
"Look at them out there! Hundreds of them!"
He stood in plain view beneath the little suns while every gook on the hill opened up on him.
"Goddamn! Look at them all!"
he exclaimed in awe. He had temporarily lost his bearings.
"Vic!"
I yelled, and others took it up.
"Get down! Vic, get down!" "There's too many of them!" he cried. "Hundreds and hundreds! Let's get out of here!"
It must have been Binns who snaked toward the dazed fireteam leader. By now, he had also been wounded. He left a blood trail on the ground.
"Shoot me! Shoot me!"
Victor pleaded, throwing up his arms. The gooks were giving it their best shot. Slugs filled the air like furious hornets around a nest.
"Somebody shoot me! Don't let them get me!"
Binns grabbed him by the ankle and yanked him off his feet, then dragged him by the foot to the cover of the big rock. That snapped Victor out of it. He looked around, swallowed, and shook his head.
"Vic!"
Binns admonished.
"Vic! Vic!"
Victor wore the look of a man jerked out of a trance. He calmly retrieved his rifle and rejoined the fight. I watched all this in cold astonishment. My hands trembled as I turned back to my own sector. The fight still raged to my left, but my section of the perimeter remained calm. I saw a collection of enemy beyond the saddle angling our way, some of whom wore the camouflage uniforms and pith helmets of North Vietnamese Army regulars. I drew bead and cracked a couple of shots, but the range was too great and the lighting uncertain. I held my fire. Grass waved in the breeze beneath flares that turned everything the same sodium tint. I got to thinking about McKinney, my friend since R.I.P. in Okinawa. He had depended on Moore and me. The small depression in which I lay offered more psychological protection than it did actual cover. The thought of leaving it filled me with dread. Yet someone should check on McKinney. He wasn't that far down, only about the distance across the average width of a house. Maybe he wasn't dead after all. Maybe he was only wounded and unconscious. If I could reach him and drag him back into the perimeter with his buddies.
"I'm going after McKinney,"
I shouted to anyone who might be listening. I didn't wait for an answer. I launched myself on the mission, cradling my M14 in my elbows. I only made it about 8 feet before the sputter of an automatic weapon interrupted progress. Bullets made sharp, cracking sounds as they snapped past my head in the dry grass.
"Hildreth, get back here!" Sergeant Howard shouted. "Stay put!"
I scurried back to my depression, faster than I left it. 39. 23:45 hours, Wednesday, 15 June, 1966. We cut down the front lines of enemy skirmishers after the flares presented them to us. Suffering heavy casualties, the attackers failed to gain momentum. Vietnamese in the rear ranks had more sense at the moment than to copy the mistakes of the dead. The enemy had had it for the time being. Whistles and bamboo sticks pulled them away from the crest of the hill to regroup. During the resulting lull, Sergeant Howard got back on the radio with the battalion CP. Facing overwhelming odds, and with our escape route cut off, he kept the message stark and simple.
"Skipper, you've got to get us out of here. There are too many of them for my people."
40. 23:55 hours, Wednesday, 15 June, 1966. Having failed in his first attack, the enemy went to earth and began probing the perimeter to find a weak spot through which the next assault might drive. VC probed one place, withdrew, then probed another. Troops in support opened fire behind the probes while small bands tried to sneak quite close to a Marine, then overwhelm him with a burst of fire or several grenades. It was nerve-wracking, not knowing when and from where the next strike would be launched. The little suns hissing against the black sky, each set replenished as soon as they fluttered out on the ground, made the job more difficult for enemy commanders, but the tall grass worked to their advantage. It allowed the enemy to get quite close before he suddenly popped up in front of you with startling presence. Tension, although of a different character, held the battalion CP and Chu Lai in its grip. Whenever somebody got into a fight out in the bush, everybody with a radio tuned in on the tactical net to monitor the outcome. Carnival time held center stage tonight. Colonel Arthur Sullivan, his XO Scotty Harris, S2 Jack Cooper, Captain Tim Garrity, Sergeant Major Turner, they all crowded around the radios in the common section. If Colonel Sullivan wasn't on the air with carnival time, he was talking to division or on the Arty and air nets, trying to shake something loose to relieve his beleaguered platoon on Hill 488. It was frustrating business trying to get the machine moving. The thinning tone of his voice revealed his annoyance. Even before tonight, Colonel Sullivan was a well-known figure at the Direct Air Support Center, DASC, of the 1st Marine Division because of his insistence upon detailed pre-planning of extraction and fire support contingencies. He couldn't understand the delay now, even though it was explained to him about priority missions and asset commitments. He demanded flare ships, helicopter gunboats, and fixed-winged aircraft, not bandying words about it.
"I'm not interested in excuses," he snapped. "My men are in trouble. That's who I'm interested in."
Not just in trouble, deep trouble. Constant firing, the whining shrieks of ricochets, and the bang of grenades filled the carnival time frequency. A sudden ping!
"That was a close one,"
exclaimed one of the platoon's radio men. Sometimes Martinez or Mulvihill came up on the air, but most of the time it was Howard. The younger radio men were excitable and talking so fast they had to be asked to slow down. Marines in the background could be heard shouting at each other and at the enemy.
"Oh, goddamn! Look at that! Look at that! That little bastard again with a 50!
At other times, carnival time went chillingly silent. The CP kept calling into open air, afraid the hill was being overrun.
"Carnival time, this is Iron Hand. Carnival time, this is Iron Hand."
Howard came up, sounding out of breath.
"I'm too goddamn busy to answer you right now."
We were busy people out there. 41. 00 hours, midnight, Wednesday, 15 June, 1966. So far, my side of the hill remained relatively inactive, while the VC concentrated on taking the shallower northern and western slopes. Artie kept popping two or three flares at a time. Lying there underneath them made me feel almost naked, but I was thankful for them nonetheless. They drove back the terrible night and let us see and shoot our foes. The enemy knew where we were. We weren't going anywhere. The flares aided us in knowing where they were. Each set of flares lasted about 3 minutes. They started out bright and high, gradually growing dimmer as they burned out and the little parachutes floated to earth. There were always periods of darkness between the dying flares and new ones come a-borning. The dark was even darker, blacker than a serial killer's soul, once you became accustomed to the light. It made you feel more vulnerable and isolated than ever. I lay waiting and listening in the total darkness, praying for the next miniature suns to start going pop, pop, pop. The VC used the darkness to change positions, to regroup and get ready for the next assault. Individual duels broke out as skirmishers searched for soft places in our lines.
"Iron Hand," I overheard Sergeant Howard saying over the radio. "We're being attacked from the west every time the flares burn out. Keep the light on up here."
"Please, God," I pleaded. "Please, keep the light on." At this point, I couldn't be sure who was dead and who alive and still in the fight. Even with the flares, I had myopic vision tunneled straight off the hill into the narrow no-man's land between us and them. It wasn't like a PA system announced the score every few minutes. During a lull, I overheard Binns talking to Powells, even though Powells probably couldn't hear him by now.
"Easy, Tom. You'll be all right, kid. You got it made. You're going back to California."
I called out softly to see who was still in the perimeter, to reassure myself that I wasn't alone. Everybody lay flat on the ground, which made it hard to see them, and even harder to tell if they were alive or dead.
"Thompson?
Yeah?
Adams?
Okay.
Mascarenas?"
No answer. Where was Mascarenas? Maybe he couldn't hear me. Our ears all rang from the grenades.
"Mascarenas?"
Still no answer.
"Billy D?"
No response.
"Sergeant Howard?
What do you want, Hildreth?"
"Just checking."
I knew we shouldn't have gone northwest. 42. 0015 hours, Thursday, 16 June 1966. Things were about to heat up in the sector Adams and I covered. Unknown to either of us, two gooks toting a 50-caliber machine gun worked their way around the hilltop to set up on the southeast above the saddle. They went to ground during the flare periods, then jumped up and moved fast when the flares went out. They were now less than 30 meters away, literally at point-blank range, and getting the gun ready to rake the top of the hill. With the machine gun squad came a security team, whose job it was to protect the gunners and prevent interference. Scrambling noises to my front during a dark period announced an alien presence. We were being probed. The thump of a grenade confirmed it. The grenade fell short. I buried my head against the expected flash. It exploded, and shrapnel buzzed over my head. Immediately after the detonation, while my ears still rang, several VC leaped up in outline against the sky, not 10 feet away. Adams sprang to his feet and charged, swinging his rifle like a ball bat. All I saw were violent shadows struggling with each other. Three of them, the larger one with the broad-brimmed hat being Adams. There were quick grunts and moans, the meaty sound of wood and steel striking flesh and bone. One shadow went down, then the other. Adams scrambled back to his position, an arm's length away, and dived to earth. A third VC appeared, charging directly at us. I dropped him dead in his tracks, 6 feet away. Hardly had I sucked in a breath of relief, than flares burst overhead, bringing light to the darkness. The enemy machine gunners were waiting for it, too. The gun opened fire in the fresh illumination. A 50 caliber was an awesome weapon that took over a battlefield with authority. It spat out projectiles with a deep thump, thump, thump. At this close range, it would lacerate the entire hilltop, literally chewing up everything in its path, including flesh and bone. Unless knocked out, 1st Platoon was done for. The first tracers lashed out over my head. Heavy slugs pounded against the big rock like sledgehammers. Somebody shouted in surprise and terror. The line of tracers tilted downward. A string of lead slapping ground walked directly over me, gouging holes in the ground and throwing dust and gravel, but miraculously leaving me unscathed. Adams fared less well. His back exploded in a thick mist of blood that splattered in the light of the flares. The impact slammed Adams over onto his back. He grunted and immediately flipped back onto his belly. In the eerie sodium light, I glimpsed the awful wound where his left shoulder blade used to be.
"I'm hit! I'm hit!" "Adams, how bad?"
Stupid question. Adams' limbs twitched.
"Bad. Real. Bad."
Like the bleat of a dying sheep. Last words. The machine gun serrated the other side of the perimeter, slashing and gouging. I snapped out of shock and kicked around to face the threat with my rifle. The VC must have seen me. The flickering giant blossom of the muzzle swirled back in my direction. Adams, brave man though he was, gave a final gasp as bullets seeking me claimed him, spattering more blood and flesh. Like he had swallowed a grenade just before it went off. His body shielded me, as in his dying, he saved my life. I looked directly into the grim faces of the VC machine gunners, into their dark eyes and into the blazing muzzle of the heavy gun. It became a personal shootout between them and me, a matter of who got who first. Bullets cracked past inches above my head. They couldn't keep missing. Everything went into slow motion. I lapsed into a momentary trance in which the larger fight no longer existed. My entire concentration focused on getting that gun before it got me. Snipers called it getting into the bubble. It wasn't difficult shooting, considering the short range, but it could be both tricky and fatal if I lost my nerve. I couldn't blow the shot by rushing it. All that sniper training in Okinawa was about to pay off. Even I was surprised at how coolly I took aim and squeezed the trigger. The first round turned out to be a tracer. I had retained an old sniper's trick of mixing tracers in my magazines as spotter rounds. The red streak it made seemed to spiral into the enemy gunner's chest, knocking him backwards out of sight. The gun went silent. Smoothly, still using what I had learned shooting in Okinawa against multiple targets, I switched aim to the assistant gunner and shot him. He disappeared in the grass.
"I got him!"
I shouted, exhilarated and excited, as though expecting applause. There was no one left to applaud. McKinney was dead. Adams was dead. I didn't know where Mascarenhas was. For all I knew, my fire team was destroyed, except for me alone defending our sector. I became aware that the rest of the platoon, those still able, had their hands full with their own individual duels and were probably not even aware that I had knocked out the machine gun that would have ended the fight. The battle hammered away unabated while a hush once more settled over my side of the hill. I lay quietly watching the machine gun in case other dinks tried to take it over. Night returned as the flares sputtered out. It was almost a blessing when it hid Adams's shredded body. I smelled his fresh blood. It left a nauseating, coppery taste in my mouth. In my mind, I ticked off the names of comrades I knew or suspected to have already died on this damnable whore of a hill. McKinney, Glaw,
Powell's, Fitzpatrick, and now Adams. Their loss left me profoundly and perhaps permanently disturbed. I experienced a sudden depth of sadness I had never known before. Life was revealing a nasty side I would rather have never known. When the lights came back on, I saw that the little sons of bitches had got hold of the machine gun and dragged it to a new location a few meters away from the original site. Two of them were getting ready to man it, while a second crew of two men set up a mortar tube. We exchanged startled looks across the distance over Adams' body, a first awareness of each other's awareness. I recovered first. I picked off three methodically and quickly, starting from left to right, since I was a right-hand shooter. They fell, one after the other, into the grass. The fourth jumped up and bolted down the hillside like a scared rabbit before I could beat in on him. I decided from then on to squeeze intermittent shots into the nest during the dark times to keep Gooks from coming back. I took a savage delight in imagining my bullets ripping into little men whose bullets had ripped into my friends. Nobody returned to the abandoned guns for the rest of the night. I lay alone, surrounded by nothing but death. Adams next to me, McKinney in the grass, and all these fucking wasted Gooks. My AOR now expanded to cover the whole of the hill's southeastern blade.
"Mascarenas?"
I whispered. Then louder,
"Mascarenas!"
There was no answer. 43. 0030 hours, Thursday, 16 June, 1966. The Reds were mustering their strength and will for a second attack. By now I had figured out their modus operandi. They went down when the lights were on, then popped back up in the short spans of darkness to maneuver, marshal, reposition, get ready, and probe our perimeter. I heard shovel work from different places out there. Vietnamese were the diggingest little fuckers. They dug tunnels, holes, and pits wherever they went. They wouldn't be building defense bulwarks, since they certainly didn't expect us to counterattack. They had to be digging in and digging in deep in anticipation of air attacks, which was our modus operandi. VC were detailed planners. Strict adherence to a plan was both their strength and their weakness. They stuck to a scenario even when things turned to shit. They planned to wipe us out, and wipe us out they were going to do. The instant the most recent flares sputtered out, whistles began blowing, bamboo clacking. Figures downslope sprang to their feet and raced up the sides of the hill. The 50s opened up with their contrapuntal chut, chut, chut.
"Get ready, men!" Sergeant Howard shouted. "The little bastards are coming again!"
The battle rejoined at point-blank range. It continued right through the next set of flares, the fighting persisting through light and through darkness. An NVA soldier in pith helmet jumped up right in front of Bill Norman, spraying a burst of fire from his AK-47 over the heads of the defenders in his excitement. It happened so fast that he was gone again before Norman could get off a shot. Norman kept his rifle trained on that spot for a while, waiting for him to jump up again, but he never did. Carlisi might not have looked like a typical Marine, but he stood his ground and fought like one. A grenade exploding near him stitched his legs and back with shrapnel. Stunned and hurt, he slid back from the edge of the hill, shook himself, then returned to the defense and kept firing. He fought on for several minutes before the shock wore off and pain caught up with him. He screamed in agony. Victor dragged him behind the big rock and shouted for the corpsman. Billy D., wounded himself several times, moved around the perimeter, checking injuries, patching up arms and legs and heads and hands. Crawling from place to place beneath the flying steel, a canvas aid bag in one hand and a rifle in the other. Getting low on supplies. He responded to Victor's call for help. While he was patching up the little New York draftee, another grenade banged near them.
Billy Dee threw himself across his patient's body to shield him from the blast, sustaining additional wounds in the process. He groaned, but finished the job on Carlisi. Carlisi pulled himself back online with his fresh bandage and his rifle. Valor was indeed common on that hilltop that night. I suspected the VC must have zeroed in on me because of my work against the machine gun and mortar. I called out to Mascarenhas to let him know I was shifting positions to my right, past Adams's body. He still failed to respond. I didn't know if he was hurt or what. I figured I was probably the only one in defense of this sector of our perimeter. I squirmed past Adams, inadvertently brushing up against his body. I recoiled at the contact. He felt like he was already getting stiff. I crawled through his gore and tried not to think about it. There would be plenty of time for that later, if there was a later. At my new location, only 10 feet or so from the old, I remained scanning my sector, hunting for targets and keeping a wary eye on the abandoned machine gun, just in case. As an afterthought, I unsheathed my K-bar and jabbed its blade into the ground near at reach and handy as a last resort. A few minutes later, grenades discharged all around in murderous blossoms of flame. I rolled downhill to avoid them. I couldn't find my K-bar when I crawled back up. I felt all around for it, but couldn't find it. Another of life's little mysteries. It was almost like the hill, a live thing itself, had stolen it from me. Bins scooted around the perimeter, collecting ammo from the dead and badly wounded, and redistributing it. A bullet creased his head. Another dug a gash across his back. More grenade shrapnel sliced into his arm, his upper lip, and his eyebrow. He kept moving, shooting, yelling, calling for more grenades to throw.
"Nice shooting, jawheads! That's the way! Who needs more ammo?"
Sergeant Howard fired Powell's M79 with deadly effect until he ran out of grenades and tossed the useless weapon aside. It wasn't long enough to use as an effective club.
"Stay alert, Marines!" he roared. "We're gonna walk out of here!"
Combat discipline held. Marines threw grenades and fired semi-auto, relying on accuracy to suppress the enemy's volume, constantly repositioning to get better fields of fire or fill in gaps. All we had to do was hold out till first light when commies turned from ants to cockroaches and faded back into the hills and jungles. The undaunted spirit Sergeant Howard displayed in front of the platoon revealed an occasional crack when he was on the radio with Colonel Sullivan. I overheard him stressing the desperation of our circumstances.
"Colonel, my boys can't hold out much longer without support." "Jim, you must hold on."
It sounded like an order, a plea, a prayer, all in one sentence. 0045 hours. On the opposite side of the perimeter from me, Corporal Gerald Thompson, first squad leader, rapidly burned up magazines. His was a hot place in the line. A grenade peppered him with shrapnel. Shock and acute pain jarred him enough that he got to his knees. A pair of hands reached out of the grass and grabbed him, pulling him down. He and the VC tumbled over the edge of the hill, locked in a deadly embrace. Thompson managed to whip out his knife as they rolled. He buried the blade to the hilt in his skinny foe's back, jabbing it deeper and ripping as he cut vitals and severed the spine. The VC stiffened, then began thrashing and whipping about in his death throes, spraying blood. The corporal scrambled back to the top.
"Corman, I've been hit!"
he called out in pain. Billy Dee was up by the big rock with Bosley, Victor, Mulvihill, and Martinez, all of whom were unleashing volley after volley into the advancing hordes. I overheard Thompson's cry for aid and turned my head to watch Billy Dee, under flare light, bellying slowly across the ground. Thompson was only about 12 feet away, but it seemed to take the corpsman forever to reach him. Billy Dee suffered from a number of untreated wounds.
He looked so bloody and so pitiful and so brave that my heart went out to him. Billy D. never reached Thompson. A grenade went off between them. Both lay still in the aftermath as the lights went out, plunging the hill once more into deepest darkness. I thought at that moment, seeing that it was all over. Help would never get here in time.
"Doc! Doc!"
I howled in anguish. Nothing.
"Thompson?"
Nothing. Most of the frag blasted into Thompson, but the concussion knocked Billy unconscious. He lay in total darkness when he revived. Spasms of pain throbbed the length of his body. His hands and his face felt warm and wet and sticky. Yet he couldn't move, couldn't shake the fog from his brain. It was like one of those nightmares in which the monsters were coming, but you couldn't move to get away from them. In a daze, he watched Thompson being dragged off the top of the hill. Two VC on their bellies had him by the head and were pulling him away from the perimeter. Then, to Billy D's growing horror, he felt hands touching him. Somebody grabbed him by the collar and started pulling him down the hill. Helpless, he hadn't the strength or the sentience to resist. All he could do was lie there on his back and be dragged across the ground, staring up into that oriental face so close to his, smelling Nook Mom sour and sweaty so that his stomach revolted at the stench. Oddly, the thing that went through his mind was, who's going to get my insurance money? What are they going to do with all that insurance money? There was no accounting for last thoughts when you expected death. Even more oddly, in the gallows humor so typical of grunts in a combat zone, he heard a revised stanza from Barry Sadler's song, Ballad of the Green Berets, run through his mind. He found it bizarrely amusing under the circumstances. It went, "Back at home a young wife waits, doing the dog with 6 or 8. 10,000 bucks she got to play, 'cause Charlie done greased her marine today." The dog was a popular dance at Annex 8, a dance spot in Fayetteville near Fort Bragg. It was so dark that from my vantage point, all I saw was a figure silhouetted against the sky and hovering over Billy D, tugging at him, pulling him off the hill. I couldn't tell if it was Thompson or not. I yelled, "Thompson?" I was frantic, trying to determine what was going on.
"Thompson?"
Much louder. Still, there was no response. Thompson surely would have said something. In another second or so, Billy D would be gone. I had to do something quick. God help me. I twisted on the ground, took aim at the outline that had to be a VC, and fired. Again, training came into play. A few inches one way or another, and I either missed completely or hit the corpsman. Billy D was staring up into the Viet's face when it exploded in front of his eyes, splattering him with bone fragments, blood, and brain tissue. The VC's hands flew to his face reflexively as the bullet knocked him on his side away from the Marine. A moment later, under the light of new flares, I saw Billy D painfully dragging himself in slow motion across the ground toward the safety of the big rock. Thompson was nowhere in sight. 44. 0100 hours, Thursday, 16 June, 1966. Marines continued to fall, and defenses on the hill weakened and thinned. Every weapon was needed. Martinez and Mulvihill were by necessity no longer radio men, but riflemen instead. Martinez, in his sump-hole depression, pumped 7.62 lead into the masses of enemy mobbing the defensive perimeter. VC went down for keeps. All around the hill, but mostly still on the north and the west. 2 or 3, then 4 or 5. Yelling and shrieking and dropping, the poor bastards. To Martinez, watching them die in the heat of battle was exhilarating.
Everyone he zapped meant fewer to scavenge over their corpses when the platoon finally fell. It wasn't a fatalistic thought. It was simply being realistic.
"Beautiful! Beautiful!"
Martinez recited, heating up his rifle barrel. Even though Sergeant Howard and Binns warned the platoon to fire semi-auto and make every shot count, we still burned up ammo at an alarming rate. Martinez scooted behind the big rock to reload and recoup. Empty rifle magazines clattered underneath his movement. He lay on an uncomfortable carpet of spent cartridge casings, while other expended hulls rained down on his patrol cap from the rifles of those popping away over the top of the rock. Recharged, he elbowed back to his old position where he could effectively fire downslope. Automatic rifle fire seared a blue-green line into his front, geysering dirt. He ducked. Slugs spanged and ricocheted off the boulder. Where the hell did that come from? That guy wasn't there a minute ago. He made the mistake of rising out of the grass to take better aim. Martinez beat it on him and fired. The VC reacted as though he'd been thumped with a baseball bat.
Beautiful! Beautiful!
0105 hours. Binns moved Norman to the other side of Kosoglow and spread Mulvihill in my direction to cover the gap left by Mascarenhas. Mascarenhas had a good reason for not answering those times I called out to him, other than his being a quiet little man from New Mexico. Apparently, grenade fragments hit him in the head and took him out of commission almost at the beginning of the action. He lay unconscious on the ground all that time. The only way anyone knew he still lived was by the gurgling and gasping noises he made when he breathed. Even those sounds seemed to be growing weaker. How characteristic of him, I thought in a wave of sadness, that he was dying the same way he lived, with hardly a word to draw attention to himself. 0106 hours. A grenade sailed over the big rock and landed next to Sergeant Howard. Howard was busy on the radio and failed to notice. Kosoglow threw himself at it and kicked it away just as it exploded. He took most of the shrapnel meant for the sergeant.
"You okay, Joe?"
Binns asked. Kosoglow retained his dry humor in spite of the pain.
"I'd rather be fishing," he wheezed.
"We can't let anything happen to the sergeant," he thought to himself. "Else we'd really be up Shit Creek." 0108 hours. Charles Bosley was also giving a good accounting of himself. He braced himself behind the big rock with Victor and Carlisi to his left. The wounded men lay on the ground slightly behind him. Sometime during the fight, the gas cylinder cap on his rifle vibrated loose and fell off. Uncomplaining as always, he kept firing, but had to manually eject each cartridge casing and reload one round at a time. Carlisi, the platoon's draftee and most unlikely Marine, didn't even notice. He was so shot up by this time that he could hardly remain erect without the rock to support him. He had a bullet hole in the left calf, another in the left foot, and his finger was shot off. Shrapnel wounds added to his misery. He propped his rifle across the top of the rock in order to fire it one-handed, the other hand being heavily padded to stop the bleeding. A grenade landed behind him and Victor. He was unable to get away from it because of his wounds. The concussion knocked him down on top of the comatose Powells. Powells didn't move. Moaning in pain, the new guy crawled over to where Binns was fighting, as though seeking psychological comfort. Binns checked for a pulse the next time he had a chance. There was none. Carlisi would never go back to New York. Victor attempted to escape the explosion that got Carlisi by diving right and to the ground. The blast caught him in midair and slammed him against the side of the rock. Wincing in pain, he pulled himself into a sitting position and tenderly rubbed his mangled legs. There was almost no feeling in them. He leaned the back of his head against the cold stone and closed his eyes, and for a brief, blissful moment, blocked out the war. It was a well-deserved respite. After that, he felt around for his rifle, found it, and staggered to his knees. He noticed Carlisi was gone. Bosley had dived for the earth in time to escape the grenade, and had now returned to the fight, still cranking out one round at a time. Moments later, a second grenade got both of them. It only peppered Bosley, but steel fragments buried themselves deep into Victor's back and knocked him breathless to the ground. Billy Dee saw him fall. He tried to crawl to the wounded men, but he moved pretty slowly himself because of his own trauma.
Stay where you are, Doc, Victor managed. I'll be all right.
Victor the pessimist and fatalist sounded more resolved and determined than in his entire life, or at least since he had been with the platoon. He hadn't the strength to regain his feet. He fully expected to die. He dragged himself with heartbreaking doggedness to the end of the big rock, where he could lie on his injured side and operate his weapon with his good arm. He fought on. At some point, he passed out. Billy Dee crawled over and, after a number of attempts, dragged him behind the big rock and treated his wounds. Victor regained awareness when the doc left to tend to another hurt Marine and crept back into his defensive position. 45. 0110 hours, Thursday, 16 June, 1966. Colonel Arthur J. Sullivan at Chu Lai listened to Howard's deep, precise voice over the radio.
Skipper, do you have a reactionary force or something? We're getting low on ammo. I don't care about myself, but I got good goddamn men out here. I'd like to get them out.
Everyone, it seemed, was eavesdropping on Carnival Times tactical channel. High-ranking officers of the 1st Marine Division, battalion and company officers and NCOs, the Special Forces soldiers Howard mistakenly called stiffballs, other recons in the field, even aircraft within range of the radio waves. VC may even have been listening in. It was the most suspenseful show going on at the time in I Corps.
Skipper, just in case.
Sergeant Howard's voice broke. Things must be really going to hell, judging from battle sounds in the background.
Skipper, tell my wife I love her.
Everyone heard the sharp scream of a ricochet that followed the sergeant's somber request. They flinched and jumped back, the bullet sounding as though it were coming through the radio at them. Howard gave a loud cry of shock and pain.
I'm hit! Oh, my balls! I'm hit! My balls! Oh!
The radio went dead, fostering an immediate assumption at the CP that Sergeant Howard had been killed and the platoon was finally about to be overrun. Looking desperate and stricken, Colonel Sullivan shouted into his handset,
Jim! Talk to me, Jimmy!
Nothing but more dead air, leaving the outcome of the fight on Hill 488 to the imaginations of those gathered around distant radios.
Get me division!
Colonel Sullivan snapped at his radio man. The battalion commander minced no words when division came up.
Damn it! My men need fire support now! They've gone off the radio. What do you have available?
Colonel, we've got A-4s on station now with rockets and 250-pound bombs. What do we tell them?
Tell them to dump everything on the north and west slopes of the hill. Where's my flare ship?
It's waiting for the A-4s to clear the area.
Damn it! Hurry!
He switched back to Carnival Time.
Carnival Time! Carnival Time! This is Iron Hand! Jim, are you there? Is anybody there?
More dead air. 46. 0115 hours, Thursday, 16 June, 1966. To an outsider, the men who piloted UH-1 Huey gunships seemed a rather rebellious, devil-may-care, anti-authority breed. That was true of most flyers who went to war. War was a hazardous occupation which, for your own peace of mind, must not be dwelt upon. Pilots, therefore, cultivated the image through rough braggadocio, dark humor. If you get shot down, can I have your stereo? And whimsical songs they made up. If I die in Vietnam, send a letter to my mom. Tell her I died with a grin, putting smoke on Ho Chi Minh. That was as true of the Marine pilots at Chulai as it was of the Army pilots with the 1st Air Cavalry Division or any of the other outfits of airmen. Oh, Chulai's a hell of a place. The organization's a fucking disgrace. There are captains and majors and light colonels, too, with thumbs up their asses and nothing to do. They sit on the runway, they scream and they shout about many things they know nothing about. For all of their worth, they might as well be shoveling shit on the South China Sea. Most gunship pilots were not much older than the grunts on the ground. The flight crews were even younger than the pilots. For all the image of recklessness and derring do, however, Marine pilots proved to be thorough professionals at the game of war who risked their lives almost daily in support of their comrades in the bush. Like cops on patrol in big cities back in the States, they were always ready to respond to a trouble call. Marine Captain Jim Perryman was flying his 2nd Vietnam tour with MAG 36, Marine Air Group 36, assigned to VMO 6 Squadron as a gunship to cover helicopter medical evacuations. Shortly after midnight of 15 June, he flew routine shotgun escort for an H-34 medevac that made a run to pick up a leatherneck wounded in a night ambush southwest of Chulai. There had been no action at the pickup point, none expected, so Perryman's chopper was still fully armed. It was a dark night. Perryman used his running lights on the way back to Chulai. He and his co-pilot anticipated hitting the rack again as they returned along the coastline with the medevac. They were not to make it, not tonight. The controller at MAG 36 broke UHF radio silence.
Klondike 03, this is Klondike 1, over.
Klondike, this is 03, over.
Klondike 03, divert to BT-135-203, Hill 488. Carnival time, needs help. Be advised, the unit has lost radio contact. Over.
Roger, 1. This is 03. Out.
With a grin and a word to his crew through the intercom, "Forget about sleep." Perryman broke off from the medevac at 5,000 feet and soared northwest alone into the entrance of the Khe San Hiep Duc Valley. The valley and its surrounding ridges and peaks lay cloaked in near-total darkness. Once Chulai lay beyond his tail rotor, hardly a pinprick of light penetrated the darkness. Vietnamese farmers went to bed early, while the VC went out to play overnight. Gunships normally operated in pairs. Lieutenant Mark Shields came up on the air to advise he had scrambled a 2nd gunboat and was on his way.
"I wouldn't want you to get all the glory, 03," he said.
A Huey gunship, heavily armed for a small helicopter, was a virtual flying armory. It was equipped with 14 2.75-inch diameter folding fin air-to-ground rockets, each with a 9-pound high-explosive warhead. Fixed-mounted for forward firing were 4 7.62-millimeter M60 machine guns. Every fourth round was a tracer. At night, the tracers, when fired, made a beam of red light shining from the bird to the ground. 4 flyers made up a gunship crew, 2 pilots and 2 crewmen who acted as door gunners. Each open door contained an M60 machine gun, either mounted on a pintle or suspended on a rubber bungee cord, which allowed the gunners to shoot in any direction. They could stand out on the skids or rocket pods and shoot underneath the helicopter. They always carried 2 or more extra barrels and an asbestos glove in order to take out hot barrels and replace them with cool. Crews sometimes shot until, at night, the barrels glowed white hot. It was about a 20-minute flight from Chulai to Nui Vu.
The hill was the highest point in the area, and therefore a landmark for airmen. Perryman knew the terrain well. He followed the crook of the valley as it twisted back toward the southwest. Ahead lay the Nuevo Hill Mass. It seemed to be celebrating the 4th of July. Green enemy tracers crisscrossed in an amazing spider's labyrinth, punctuated by quick white light explosions. Marines on top of the hill were still putting up one hell of a fight. Perryman soared lower over the peak to take a closer look, but stayed out of gunfire or RPG range. He noted two crucial factors. There was no way helicopters could land in that melee. The fight was so closely joined, it was impossible to distinguish the Marine perimeter.
Klondike 1, Klondike 03. Be advised the unit is still fighting and has not been overrun.
47. 0130 hours, Thursday, 16 June 1966. Sergeant Howard lay wounded and dazed, almost unconscious. Binns crawled to him to take over. He attempted to tug the radio handset from the sergeant's death grip. Howard resisted. Binns jerked it free. Sergeant Howard shook himself to clear his head. He snatched back the handset.
"God damn it, Binns," he growled. "I'm not done for yet."
The bullet had gone through his lower back, and his legs were paralyzed. Permanently or temporarily, he didn't have time to consider now. He grunted in pain as he shifted to a less uncomfortable position.
"How long was I out?" he asked.
"A minute or two," Binns said.
"How are we doing?"
"Hanging tough, but..."
There was no need for Binns to finish the sentence. It was the low point of the night and the fight. Word went around the perimeter that Sergeant Howard was hit, and blood froze in our veins. Howard was our rock. We depended on him for guidance and strength. Although we had beaten back the attack, shooting continued, unabated, rolling back and forth across the perimeter. Long bursts of machine gun and automatic weapons fire raked the hilltop, rattling for a minute or two at a time. Somebody would see something, and things started up heavy again. Every Marine on the hill had to be thinking the same thing. We were merely waiting for the other shoe to drop. We could never repel a third massed charge by an enemy determined to eradicate us. We would all die in the next assault. All you had to do was look around to understand that. Eerie illumination from the flares revealed the bloody wreckage of a platoon literally making a last stand. Like General Custer at the Little Bighorn, Colonel Davy Crockett and James Bowie at the Alamo, Marines on Wake Island. I had been scared all night, but now I was really scared. I couldn't help it, and I knew it was the same with the others. A sense of despair, of impending doom and certain death, settled over the battered survivors of 1st Platoon. A boiling kettle of mixed feelings that included a deep sense of anguish and loss, of the natural rage young adults experienced as we were about to die prematurely. For the first time since the battle began, I knew we all felt like giving up. We mustn't give up to the VC. We couldn't let the enemy take us alive. We had all heard too many accounts of the atrocities the VC inflicted upon any Marine unfortunate enough to be taken prisoner, such as the one about a platoon of the 9th Marines who lost one of their guys to the VC. All night long, the VC tortured him within hearing distance of the dug-in platoon. His screams of agony shredded the night, but there was nothing anyone could do. The next morning, his buddies found his naked body painted red with blood and strung up in a tree by his heels. Pieces of flesh were hacked out of his belly and legs and arms. He was scalped, and his entrails strung out on the ground. His privates were cut off and rammed into his rectum while he was alive. The tongue was saved for last,
because the gooks wanted him to scream until the last minute. Or the one about the Mama-san, who tied up a captured American soldier, put a basket around his neck, filled the basket with rats, and sewed a lid over the top of his head to make sure the rats stayed around his face and got good and hungry. Better a quick death than that, and better to take some of them with us. It was hopeless otherwise. I simply lost heart. I turned my head toward the big rock and shouted a shrill, desperate cry.
"Sergeant Howard, don't let them get us! Please! Call a fire mission in on our position!"
Erase our colored grease pencil off the map. Turn it black. Whatever. Norman and Kosoglo, among others, took up the plea.
"Have mercy on us, Sarge," Kosoglo begged. "Let's take him with us."
Now seriously wounded, Sergeant Howard must have also glimpsed the abyss. His state of mind was in such temporary disrepair that, coughing, in severe pain, he got back on the horn and requested artillery be dropped on coordinates BT-135203.
"And keep 'em coming," he added.
The puzzled FTC came back with,
"Carnival time, say again, coordinates."
Sergeant Howard did. Still believing the request to blow off the top of the hill an error, Artie responded that the mission was not authorized. Before the exchange could go further, Colonel Sullivan interrupted.
"Carnival time? Carnival time? Jim, is that you? Are you still there?"
Sergeant Howard composed himself. Almost as quickly as he vanished, the old hardcore sergeant returned. There would be no other suggestions given or taken that we blow up ourselves and take them with us. He came back up on the radio to Colonel Sullivan, his voice intentionally falsetto high and lilting, loud enough that we could all hear. The message was really meant for the platoon.
"Yes, sir, Colonel. I'm here. If my voice has changed, you'll know where I've been hit."
"Jim, thank God. Hold on out there, son. TAC Air is on the way."
Sergeant Howard's response had its intended outcome in a resurgence of morale. Kosoglo even chuckled. Billy D. crept over and offered to administer morphine for the sergeant's pain.
"Are you taking it, Doc?"
Sergeant Howard asked, turning down the painkiller.
"No."
"Why?"
"The men need it worse."
The sergeant nodded.
"I have to stay alert. This fight's not over yet. Not by a long shot."
48. 0145 hours, Thursday, 16 June 1966. How long had the fighting gone on? 2 hours? 3? A week? A month? Time lost all meaning. Having been badly mauled twice, the VC would be listening for signs to indicate we were shattered or demoralized before they stormed the hill a third time. They reverted to psychological warfare during a lull, in which virtually all firing ceased for quite long periods. They must have watched the same old Wallace Beery movie I had, in which the Japanese surrounded the American heroes and started bellowing taunts in high-pitched, accented English.
"Americans, you die!"
Insults Marines had heard in other places, in other wars, floated up the slopes in high, sing-song voices.
"Marines, you die tonight! Marines, you die in 1 hour!
Voices screeched from a number of different places out of the darkness. Instead of being intimidated, however, we reacted with rage.
"Motherfuckers!" Kosoglo snarled. "Sarge, can we yell back at them?"
"Go ahead. Yell anything you want. Tell them what we think of them."
Thus inspired and given the official go-ahead, the surviving Marines of Hill 488 enthusiastically responded with all the curses and invective we could muster from our inventive collective repertoire mastered in a world without the gentling influence of women. It felt even better than shooting at them.
From all over the hill, badly wounded Marines, Marines unable to walk but who could still pull a trigger, Marines weakening from loss of blood, we all found a voice and hurled back what they threw at us and even worse. I yelled at them until my throat went scratchy, venting my fury and sense of helplessness.
"Fuck you! You motherfuckers haven't got us yet! Come on up here, you pussies, and eat shit! Stuff it up your asses! Here's one for your mother, cocksuckers!"
Somebody fired off a burst. God, it felt good. Screaming and letting it all out.
"Cram it! Ram it! Rotate it, you little cocksucking sons of bitches!"
The gooks soon ran out of English. How many ways could they say, "Marine, you die!" with the same impact? They resorted to their native language. We roared back and forth at each other. It wasn't necessary to understand the words. We understood the meaning. Some of them started shooting again out of frustration.
"Hey, top-notch," Bin said. "Ain't that a laugh?"
"Yeah, ain't it?" Howard said. Then an idea struck him. The opportunity to deliver a masterstroke in psychological one-upmanship. In a low voice, he said,
"That's right. It is a laugh. All right, Marines, give 'em the old horse laugh. All together now. Ready? When I count to three."
There can be few moments in the annals of combat to compare in sheer audacity to that one. The handful of us, beleaguered, outnumbered, and apparently hopelessly trapped, seemed to infect each other with a kind of gleeful exhilaration. The situation wasn't funny, not a bit, but suddenly it was funny. The more we laughed, the funnier it became. The laughter was loud, genuine, rollicking, contagious, and it went on and on, laughing in the faces of the enemy. I could almost see the gooks out there with their eyes bugged out and their jaws dropped. They must have thought we were going insane. Whatever they thought, it temporarily silenced them. Months later, captured enemy troops admitted the moment had a shattering psychological impact on them. It was the turning point in the fight. Whereas a few minutes before we had been at our lowest ebb, we were now soaring. We were going to beat these sons of bitches. Sergeant Howard keyed his mic because he wanted the CP to hear. Colonel Sullivan had fought in 3 wars, but he could recall nothing to match it. He looked stunned as laughter poured out of the radio like a freshet of water. Sergeant Major Turner blinked and slowly allowed himself a guilty grin. Some of the others in the commo tent started to laugh along with the trapped Marines.
"Those crazy, magnificent bastards!" Colonel Sullivan exclaimed, expressing the sentiment of everyone listening.
Everything got better fast. Out of the ensuing silence at the end of the laughter crackled a voice from an Air Force C-47 pilot with the poetic call sign of Smoky Gold.
"Carnival time. This is Smoky Gold. We're on station overhead. Where do you want these flares? Over."
As if in echo from heaven came other voices. An A-4 Skyhawk flight leader radioed,
"Carnival time. We're approaching your position now."
Helicopter gunships circled overhead.
"Carnival time. This is Klondike 03. Do you read? We have some special delivery for your guests."
The cavalry was coming, just like in the movies. God, it was a good feeling. Maybe we had a chance after all. But daylight was still a long way off. 49.
0150 hours, Thursday, 16 June, 1966. With TAC Air arrived a renewed hope for survival. Sporadic firing resumed. More grenades sailed in. I looked for my K-bar again, but still couldn't find it. I strained my ears, listening for rustling in the grass, scanned the tops of the grass as it rippled in the breezes, looking for movement to give them away. Occasionally, nursing my dwindling supply of ammo, having already twice shared my basic load with the platoon, I fired a round or two down the hillside to discourage approach. I looked up at the sky, waiting for TAC Air to start making runs. Red and green running lights from the circling helicopters blinked against distant cold stars. I didn't see the jets, but Smoky Gold was up there. I could hear him. He kicked out flares, and they lit up the world, blinding me so that the suns were all I saw and the aircraft were hidden behind them. Sergeant Howard pulled in the perimeter even tighter since we had lost so many defenders. The diameter of the defense from the big rock on the north to me on the southeast was only about 10 steps. I now lay prone a few feet away from Mascarenhas on my left and Adams to my right. Mascarenhas hadn't moved at all in at least 2 hours. The only way I knew he was alive was when I heard him sucking air. He would suck in with a gurgling sound, chain Stokes breathing, and then lay without catching his breath for long minutes at a time, or so it seemed. I looked toward him, underneath the flares, my face on a level with his on the ground. We were only about 8 or 10 feet apart. His head lay turned to his right, pointing down the slope. Each time he breathed the gurgling sound, it cut deep into my heart. I felt a combination of guilt and remorse. It's hard to explain. I actually felt guilty because I alone, out of an 18-man platoon, remained the only man not wounded or not dead. Of my 4-man fire team, McKinney and Adams were dead, and Mascarenhas was almost dead. My squad leader, Corporal Thompson, was dead. Everyone had at least one wound, except me. Strange, frightening thoughts ran through my head. My God, what is the matter with me? Why haven't I been wounded yet? Why are my friends dying while I'm still alive? What are you saving me for, God? Something even more terrifying than what we've already seen? Each time I breathed in air, I drew in the sickly stench of coagulating and fresh blood, cordite, smoke, and human fear. And now I felt guilty because my blood wasn't mixed with all the others. I was one sick, confused Marine, fucked up from the shock and horror. To me, in my present state of tumult, it seemed I actually willed myself to get hit. I spotted a form downhill in the shadows and popped off a couple of quick rounds. A few minutes later, a burst of light machine gun fire. It sounded like a BAR, Browning automatic rifle, spanged a string of steel off the big rock. A ricochet thumped me hard in the ribs, like a piece of the night doubled its fist and hit me with everything it had. The blow actually shoved me 2 or 3 inches across the ground and knocked the breath out of me.
"I'm hit! I'm hit!"
I gasped as soon as I was able. It was a call for help. At the same time, it was an expression of relief. With that wound, I became a member of 1st Platoon once more in good standing. We were all wounded now. We were all really in this together. I was also scared half to death because I didn't know how badly I was hit. I unbuttoned my utility shirt and felt the tender welt and cut skin. It didn't seem too bad. Billy D. showed up in response to my cry. Like a man obsessed with duty, he refused to quit until he literally couldn't drag himself across the ground. He was a lot worse off than I.
"Where are you hit?"
Billy D. asked, his voice stretched as thin and tight as a guitar string.
"It's my side. I think I'm all right. I don't feel any blood."
I couldn't tell him I was glad it happened.
"Let us have a look. I'm okay."
I dared not roll onto my side and provide an inch or two more of myself as a target. Doc took my word for it and crawled away to assist other wounded. Binns scooted over to check on me.
"You all right, Hildreth?"
Yeah.
It was a good feeling having them check on me. Bins returned to the big rock. My side hurt like hell, like I had been kicked by an Oklahoma mule. Nonetheless, I peered down the hillside with new resolve, feeling better now and more settled. I no longer felt guilty. 50. 0200 hours, Thursday, 16 June, 1966. For some reason, we found inexcusable, which even Colonel Sullivan couldn't understand, and because of which he was almost livid with anger, it had taken more than 2 hours to get tactical air overhead. Later, it was explained that the problem wasn't so much in getting aircraft as it was in trying to figure out how to aid us in the dark, with the enemy so near, our lines actually merged. At the best of times, TAC air was not the asset of choice for real close-in support. To even contemplate using it in the dark, with all the smoke and confusion on the ground, bordered on criminal lunacy. But something had to be done. Artillery barrages had proved ineffective, the rounds exploding too far away from where they were needed to do much good. To be fair, the hilltop was one small geographical feature. To get HE on that feature within a few feet of the Marines without actually putting it square on top and wiping us out was an almost impossible task. I suppose Division Brass, goaded by Colonel Sullivan, probably decided we were gone anyhow, so they might as well give TAC air a chance. From Captain Jim Perryman's point of view, overhead in his attack chopper, the question was a simple one of not whether to strike, but rather how to strike in the dark, in a battle so closely joined, without killing Marines. Looking down, he saw the objective as a black pool with the hulking shape of a mountain barely visible in that pool. Muzzle flashes strobed and tracers zipped, but they did little to differentiate between who was who down there. Perryman could not even imagine what those trapped Marines must be going through. It was difficult to distinguish lines drawn between friendlies and foes, even when smoky gold popped flares, illuminating Nuit-Vue and surrounding terrain. The lines formed a confusing labyrinth that appeared to be fused together. At least, that was the way it looked from the air.
"My God!" exclaimed Smoky Gold. "Look at them all! All over the hillside! It looks like an anthill ripped open!"
The analogy had been used before. Sergeant Howard shouted over the radio in his exhilaration and anxiousness,
"Klondike! They're coming for us! Why aren't you firing?"
"We can't determine your position, Carnival Time," Perryman responded. "We can't see anything except weapons fire. We might strike you."
"Spray the area, Klondike! Everything within 20 meters around the top of the hill!"
"Stand by, Carnival Time."
The strike required superb coordination and cooperation. For one thing, it wouldn't do to have an A-4 suck one of Smoky Gold's parachute flares into its jet intake. That would ruin your night. The helicopters had to stay out of the way of the jets, and the Skyhawks had to watch out for Smoky Gold and the two Klondikes now on station. Together, bunching on the same tactical channel, the various pilots came up with a plan of action. The gunships and the A-4s would alternate in their initial attacks. Perryman and Mike Shields, in their respective Hueys, would perform a secondary role as TACs, tactical air controllers, by marking and directing jet bombing runs. They would fly in the dark while the jets timed their approaches either underneath the high flares or immediately after the flares extinguished. To mark specific targets, the Klondikes directed Smoky Gold to drop flares on the ground as signal lights. Communications over the tactical frequencies crackled with excitement and urgency.
"Skipper, if you can keep 'em from coming up the hill,"
Sergeant Howard radioed Iron Hand,
"we'll fight 'em off our backs up here."
"All right, Jim, you got it,"
Colonel Sullivan replied. The first order of business was to coordinate air with ground.
"Carnival Time, We're going to make a pass, Perryman radioed. Do not fire. I say again, hold your fire.
He waited for the flares to extinguish, no sense making a more visible target of himself, and kept his external red and green beacons lit so Carnival Time could see the helicopter and make adjustment. The Huey came in low and fast through the saddle opening in the ridge and skimming the hill's northeastern face. The VC were brave and disciplined. They held their ground and tried to shoot the helicopter down. Green tracers weaved webs around it. The gunship made its low pass, whooped up and out.
"You're close, but that looked pretty good,"
Sergeant Howard complimented him.
"Roger that, Carnival Time. Keep your heads down. We're gonna get closer."
On his next pass, while Shields' bird hung fire in the air, Perryman came in low and released rockets. Both door gunners blistered the enemy. The pass brought an immediate response from Carnival Time.
"No, no! Jesus Christ, you're shooting at us! Back off! Back off!"
Perryman pulled into a steep climb out of the cauldron before he did damage to us.
"Carnival Time, be advised we cannot tell you from Victor Charlie. We see people everywhere. We need you to mark your position. Over." "Gunboat, we're out of flares. The only thing I have is a flashlight with a red-filtered lens. Can you home in on that?"
"Roger, Carnival Time. We'll take a stab at it. Give us your red light."
Klondike 03 circled Nuivu, searching for the red light in all that flashing and flickering and streaking. He had a difficult time. Finally, he located it.
"Gotcha, Carnival Time. Now, where do you want our ordnance?"
"Fire everywhere outside a 20-meter radius of the red light. Lay it any closer, and you'll really cream us."
"Roger, Carnival Time."
Perryman prepped his crew, made sure his gunners and co-pilot understood the parameters.
"Be careful," he told them. "We're going in."
The chopper veered into a dive to attack a large concentration of VC advancing up the north slope. Tracer red from the Huey's fixed forward-firing machine guns and door guns stomped across the slope, chewing up everything in its path. Fire whipped down from the bird. It was like watching a big red snake cracking out of the sky like lightning. Rockets left contrails from the helicopter's pods, creating bright explosions that rattled the countryside and echoed in relays down the valley. We were gaining fire superiority in a big way. Skyhawks burned fuel at an amazing rate and therefore had limited time over target. They made their passes, guiding on terrain marked by the helicopters. On the ground, we heard the roar of their engines coming out of the black sky for what seemed like hours before they actually arrived, but arriving silently, outrunning their sounds. They rolled in and almost directly overhead in the ghastly light of the 3 million candle-power flares popped at 3,000 feet and swaying underneath their tiny parachutes. Flying between the flares and the ground, putting iron on the target with 250-pound bombs. The first bomb felt like it landed 10 feet away. The fierce little fighter dumped its load and was gone all in an instant. The tremendous concussion of the bomb and the delayed roar of the jet engine coalesced in a crack that seemed to open a hole through the universe. I felt like standing up and cheering, except I couldn't have stood up had I been so foolish as to try. The ground shook like from an earthquake. That damnable hill was being smashed into submission. While maintaining vigilance over my TAOR, I watched the jets with mixed fascination, horror, and numbness, gripping the soil to keep from being thrown off the planet as the warbirds streaked over us one after the other. Each one seemed to come in lower than the previous and closer to our perimeter. It seemed the pilots meant to land, get out on foot, and fight. How could they be so accurate and so close without dropping a bomb right on top of us? They concentrated on the approaches to Nuivu, as well as on the hill itself, laying their ordnance in downhill directions so shrapnel burst away from the hilltop. Making pass after pass, grim pilots in the cockpits performing the precision, close-support bombing for which they were becoming famous. Mushroom explosions only a few yards away from our outpost tore up the VC and jostled us with the impact, sometimes bouncing us 2 feet off the ground. Smoke and fire writhed downward like boiling lava. The hill was what pilots called a target-rich environment. The acrid smell of cordite mixed sharply with the stench of jet fuel, blast haze. It was terrible. It was wonderful. As quickly as the jets were out of the way, the gunships returned, fast and dangerous, picking off stragglers, surveying the damage and directing more runs. Whooping and thumping and scouring the hillsides with machine gun and rocket fire, like miniature storm clouds hurling lightning bolts, flying at altitudes as low as 20 feet above the grass and bushes. Whereas the A-4s made their appearances on stage, then had to zip back to Chu Lai to recoup, one or another of the gunships remained over us like a guardian angel, one staying while the other scooted back to Chu Lai to refuel and rearm. "We're heading back to rearm," Perryman in Klondike 03 might say. "Be back most skosh."
"Klondike," Sergeant Howard said quickly. "Can you get that little motherfucker with the machine gun northwest of us before you go?"
Captain Shields came on the air.
"Carnival time, this is Klondike 04. I'll be your pilot, over." "Roger that! Glad you're here. Can you see my red light?" "Roger back. Now, where's that little motherfucker you want us to burn?"
The gunships kept switching back and forth like that. Sergeant Howard always had a job for them.
"Keep 'em coming, Klondike," Howard cheered. "Lay 'em right in our back pockets. It's the only way to stop the fuckers. We still have automatic weapons firing at us."
Perryman was back.
"Carnival time, I can't see the auto weapon."
Mulvihill stood up.
"I can see him,"
he shouted to Sergeant Howard. He cranked off 4 rounds. That elicited instant feedback from the hidden gun. As Mulvihill intended, blue-green tracers gave away the VC's position.
"I see him now, carnival time," Perryman said, and a moment later knocked out the machine gun.
He drew fire in the process.
"Klondike, you got 250s firing at you,"
Sergeant Howard warned. Mulvihill opened up on the nearest heavy machine gun. A grenade from a different source exploded next to him. He fell, painfully wounded for the second or third time. He soon recovered and pulled himself back into position to continue the fight. Support coming as it did just in the nick of time provided motivation and reawakened courage in those of us on Nuivu Hill who had all but resigned ourselves to our fate. We might still be out here in the middle of the night with enemy all around, but the break in odds provided a new chance and possibly changed the outcome of the battle. Colonel Sullivan was coming through for us. Hope returned to Sergeant Howard's voice.
"Beautiful," he radioed Smoky Gold. "Keep them flares coming."
To Klondike, he added,
"Good job. Do it again. Can you get the machine gun northwest of us?"
"Roger." Ultimately, jets and helicopters expended over 200 2.75-inch rockets, 23,000 rounds of M60 machine gun ammo, 1,750 rounds of 20-millimeter cannon, 44 bombs and 16 Zuni rockets in defense of Hill 488. Although we hoped, prayed, that the VC would withdraw, we could have saved our energy. They still weren't ready to quit, even though they appeared frightened by the aircraft and their attacks subsided for a short period. They stayed, perhaps, because they had been ordered to wipe out the Marines at any costs. They stayed, perhaps, because their commanding officers had been killed and subordinates continued to follow dead orders. They stayed, perhaps, because they thought victory was still attainable. The VC knew how to stick to a plan, come shit or high water. That artillery fire and TAC air could blow an area to smithereens until not a blade of grass remained standing, and the VC survive, was testimony to their amazing shovel work. All that digging we heard down there must have resulted in some awfully deep holes and bunkers. Pilots, fearful of hitting us, had to leave a narrow space around our perimeter, untouched, and still growing tall grass. Into those spaces crawled the Vietnamese, where they hugged the line closely, making it difficult for artillery and aircraft to get them. Every time the flares went out, the enemy jumped up in that safe zone, determined to take the hill at any cost, pounding us while they, in turn, were pounded. Savage, point-blank fighting continued. Fighting remained so intense that neither Colonel Sullivan nor Sergeant Howard could ask choppers to try to rescue us. We would simply have lost aircraft and more good men.
"Jim, you'll have to hold on till morning," Colonel Sullivan reluctantly informed his battered platoon leader.
Jesus God, dawn was still over 3 hours away. 51. 0400 hours, Thursday, 16 June 1966. What should have been a dispirited force threw its weight first against one side of the tiny marine perimeter atop Hill 488, then against the other. The VC and NVA were well trained and demonstrated good fire discipline. They were not a local yokel outfit. They had a lot of ammo to burn on us. Although badly mauled, the bad guys still had us ringed in. Fortunately, they no longer attempted to mass for a big rush. Each time, they had been bounced back with heavy losses. Plus, TAC air dealt them so many casualties, they were afraid to mass. Knowing what the jets and Hueys and artillery and our sharpshooting did to them further down on the slopes, they hugged the perimeter, dug in not 30 meters away, and tried to cut down any Marine who raised up and silhouetted himself against flares or the skyline. 2 of the enemy battalion's 4 original 50-caliber machine guns survived to lace the hill in a net of green tracers. A light machine gun, a BAR or RPD, positioned itself downslope on the north. Instead of waiting for targets, its gunners began bouncing bullets off the big rock in hopes of catching some of us with deadly ricochets. Sure enough, one of them got Martinez. Throughout the fight, the radio man from Kansas battled from the same place, next to the sump hole near the big rock. The sump hole, Martinez saw by flare light, now contained several Chi-Com grenades that failed to go off. He avoided them with great care. He crawled around the outside of the depression to the edge of the hill, checked the area, and fired off rounds when he spotted movement, then wriggled back around the edge of the depression to his alternate position at the rock. He was on his way back to the rock with ricocheting bullets and tracers buzzing overhead when one of them caught him in the back, like someone hit him with a fist and knocked the wind out of him. He already had grenade fragments in his legs.
"I'm hit,"
he groaned when he caught his breath. He gestured at Mulvihill.
"Check me out, Dan."
Mulvihill slid over to him. Billy D was busy elsewhere. Martinez kept his weapon ready.
"You're hit really hard in the back," the Chicago radio man determined. "It's right next to your spine, but I can't tell. Can you move your legs?"
Martinez tried.
"Yeah," he said. "Go ahead and patch me up."
It would have been a disabling wound at any other time, but tonight anyone who could still move and fire a weapon wasn't considered disabled. Both men returned to their battle positions. Martinez wasn't in a great deal of pain yet.
"Dan?" "Yeah, Martinez?" "Thanks."
Nearby, a grenade landed next to Bill Norman. He rolled away from it and buried his face in the dirt underneath his arms. He waited and waited, but the grenade never went off. First Platoon, along with artillery and air assets, extracted a fearsome price from the enemy. We had also paid, and paid dearly. I overheard Sergeant Howard on the radio during a lull, delivering our casualty report. 7 wounded so severely they were either unconscious or conscious and unable to move, even though they fought on. 6 more wounded but still fighting. At least 5 dead.
"This is one hell of a bunch of men," the sergeant relayed to Colonel Sullivan during a slow period. "The good Lord never put a better crew on this earth. These men are doing more to get the job done than anybody could ever expect of them. Skipper, I don't want to see any more of them die."
Colonel Sullivan sounded like he had something in his throat.
"Neither do I, Jim. Neither do I."
Although I occasionally saw bad guys flitting from place to place, most of the activity was happening on the other side of the hill from me. I lay on the top, barely able to see down over the crest into the tall grass where McKinney lay. It seemed like a year ago, a decade, since McKinney's poncho fluttered down almost on top of me. Yesterday and the day before, when we hung loose up here, reading and basking in the sunshine like a bunch of tourists, had to have been at least a lifetime ago. Tonight was the longest night I could ever remember. Why would anyone want this hill so badly, I wondered, that he would sacrifice so many lives to take it? It was a worthless hunk of real estate. It wasn't a big hill, as far as mountains went, nor was it a productive hill. It wasn't even much for looks. As far as I could tell, rainwater washed right off and left it so dry it grew nothing except brown-looking grass, a few shrubs, some weeds, and rocks. There were no obvious minerals. Nobody could live up here. It had a feel of evil about it, especially after tonight. And especially after tonight it was sure to be haunted by the restless spirits of the dead, ghosts the Vietnamese called pratas. We didn't want the hill. Neither did the Viet Cong. If we succeeded in holding it, tomorrow the helicopters came for us, we abandoned it, and went away. If the VC seized it, tomorrow they abandon it and climb back down. What sense did it make to fight over something nobody wanted? We Marines weren't fighting for this damnable hill, I realized. We fought because we had no other choice, and we fought so fiercely because we fought for our lives and for each other. It was no more complicated than that. Life on the hill that night returned to simple basics, tooth and claw, survival for the clan. The night was not our friend. It was the enemy's friend. Our survival depended on holding out until daybreak. My eyes anxiously and longingly scanned the eastern horizon in the direction of Chulai. This must be the darkness before the dawn.
"Sarge! I'm really low on ammo,"
someone whispered.
"Me too,"
came an echo that relayed itself around the perimeter. Billy D. had 2 magazines of ammunition left. He gave 1 of them to Victor, who had only 10 rounds remaining. Mulvihill had fewer cartridges left than Victor. Bosley gave them each 1 of his magazines because he had been firing single action the entire night due to his missing gas cylinder cap. None of us had grenades left. I still had 2 mags remaining and a partial in my M14. Sergeant Howard ordered redistribution, followed by the admonition to fire only at identifiable targets, and then only 1 shot at a time. It didn't take a math professor to calculate how precarious times were becoming. I crawled over to Adams's body to retrieve any ammunition he may have had left. I felt queasy robbing a dead man, but I knew he wouldn't have minded under the circumstances. He lay in a thick pool of sour, congealing blood. I found 2 magazines in his magazine holder. Unbelievably, Mascarenhas still lived. Rasping breaths hissed through his teeth in quick gasps, followed by long pauses. I removed two more magazines from him. Even though he was wounded and in severe pain, Sergeant Howard never ceased to encourage the battered platoon, reminding us that more Marines were ready to come in at daylight to get us out. Daylight? I hardly remembered what daylight was like. Enemy soldiers pushed their way through the close-in grass in another probe. Sergeant Howard, relying on cunning, issued what surely had to be one of the most unusual combat orders in recent history.
"Throw some rocks," he whispered.
What? Had it come down to that? Rock throwing? Primitive survival in its most fundamental evolutionary step?
"They'll think we have grenades," he explained. "When they jump out of the way, we'll zap 'em."
As incredible as it sounded, it worked again and again. As Powell's might have said, were he able,
"Them goddamn gooks will never learn."
I felt around on the ground until I found a couple of fist-sized stones. Every time I heard a sound, I hurled one of the rocks and waited ready with my rifle. Attackers instinctively sprang away from the thunk of the grenades, exposing themselves and allowing us to make every shot count. Just like squirrels back in the woods of Oklahoma, they couldn't keep their heads down. The range was generally less than 30 feet. A lot of gooks ended up with holes in their foreheads. It was becoming a crazy fight. The enemy fired automatic weapons. We replied with single shots. The enemy tossed grenades. We threw back rocks. Victor the Mormon threw his empty canteen and scored with it. Pessimist though he was, he rallied and became a funny kid under the circumstances. He started slinging sea rat cans, commenting that the rations were deadly if we could get the dinks to eat them. Finally came the desperate report everyone dreaded.
"I'm out of ammo."
And an echo just as chilling.
"So am I."
Air cover and artillery kept the hillsides cleared, but it was up to us to either kick Charlie back from the crest or go down beneath the onslaught. Soon now it would be rocks, knives, rifle butts, teeth, and claws. We waited, anticipating the final assault. I still couldn't find my K-bar.